So you all know that today is Earth Day, and last week I talked about human nature, and I hoped to provoke some thinking on your part about the nature of human nature, nature of humans. So today we're talking about Earth nature, nature. And maybe this will also be provoke some thinking or some reflections on your part. One of the very significant images, Buddhist images, that comes down through the ages, is the image of the Buddha touching the earth. And it's an image that comes from the time that he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, setting himself up to practice and become enlightened. And it said that that he had some doubts about, or the way that the mythological way in which it's talked about, it said that Mara came to the Buddha and challenged. And it's a little bit loud. Is this a little loud for you? You okay with it, everyone? Everybody's okay with it. Okay. The so Mara came to the Buddha and challenged him for his right to become enlightened, to become liberated. Who are you? You know, you're some kind of schmuck. You know, what right have you? You know, you, to do anything and being, you know, being liberated is you become liberated. In Indian context was to attain a fairly high status, spiritual status in a sense. So who are you to kind of step into this high status? Some of us have a lot of doubts ourselves about, is it okay to let go deeply? Is it safe? Where does that leave me? Maybe I won't be anybody. Maybe I won't fulfill my responsibilities. Maybe I'm not worthy of that. Maybe I'm such a lousy person myself that I can't possibly hope for a full liberation, full awakening. That's only for great spiritual adepts, not for someone who's stumbling along like me. So there's all kinds of doubts. So Mara was the one who voiced these doubts to the Buddha. And I think it's quite significant that among many of the challenges the Buddha faced in his path to enlightenment, he faced them with tremendous resolve, tremendous personal strength and ability to face and be present. And this is the one time when these doubts arose. This is the one time when the stories tell us he didn't rely on his own abilities, but rather what he did was he reached out and he touched the earth, and he called upon the earth to be his witness to his right to be awakened. And you probably, you see statues that depict this, and you see he's sitting like this one here in meditation posture, and then his right hand he reaches forward and puts over his knee and lets it fall down, so the fingers reach down just very lightly, are touching the ground. Now in the ancient mythology, it isn't that he touches the ground, but what he calls upon is the goddess of the earth, the earth goddess, who's been around for a very long time and has witnessed everything, and says, you know, I've been around, you know, you've been a witness to my practice and who I am and my many lifetimes of practice, and please bear witness, please speak up now and say that it's okay for me to be liberated. And so the earth goddess responds with an earthquake, and that gets Mara's attention. Earthquakes are quite significant in Buddhism. Certain earthquakes are. So Mara realizes and gets frightened and runs away. And so it's mythology, and the question is, you know, how do we understand mythology? And as with all images, these kinds of images, they're evocative. And as societies and culture changes, I think images and mythology are interpreted and understood in new ways. And so this image of the Buddha touching the earth, calling upon the earth as a witness, calling upon the earth to help him at a time when he couldn't help himself, I think speaks very interestingly for many of us. Maybe there's a time in our practice when we can't rely on our own efforts anymore, and we have to kind of reach out to something, and one of the things we can reach out to is nature, the earth, the nature around us, if we have it close by. I guess you could, I don't know, maybe it works if you reach out and touch the asphalt. I don't know, they didn't have asphalt, so I don't know, maybe it, but you know, my idea is, you know, you reach out and touch the earth, you usually do it by touching the ground, the earth, the soil. And this idea that there's some part of nature, it's a nature that we are so deeply connected to nature, that somehow it's our connection to nature that somehow will allow some final release. And one of the ways to see that is that it's very well known in Buddhism that the some of the most profound experiences of liberation and freedom is not something that you can will or you can do, or that yourself, as myself, you know, I'm the one in charge here and I can do all these things and I'm capable and I'm going to show, you know, be the first one in my block to be enlightened. That there's a kind of bringing the self and your ego, your egotism, your self-centeredness, and your, even your self-centered will to try, I'm going to force my way into enlightenment, doesn't work. It requires deep letting go and allowing, in a sense, some other process, something else besides our self-centered will to function. And for some people discover this very early in the practice because that's what's needed early on. Some people discover this very late in their practice because that's what's needed then. Different people discover it at different times. It isn't like one's right or wrong. Some people find that personal effort works really well for years. It carries them quite far on the path. And then they come to a point where they realize they have to let go of that. And other people, personal effort just ties them in knots to begin with, right away. And so they have to kind of learn to let go and trust something wider and deeper. And here, that's represented perhaps by nature. So that's one way, maybe, of understanding this ancient myth or the image of the Buddha touching the earth. Touching the earth is a very intimate thing to do. You're in touch. And however, you're not the same. There's kind of a kind of, you're not quite the same as the earth, but you're also not separate either. And there's this interesting balance between being very closely connected and also at the same time separate enough to know that you're connecting, know that you're separate and make that connection. So another image that exists down through the ages in Buddhism is that of the full moon. It represents the enlightened mind, the mind that's completely luminous, the mind which all the clouds of the mind, the defilements of the mind, the hindrances of the mind, the clings of the mind have all kind of drifted away. And so the full luminosity of the mind shines forth. So the full moon represents that. And in Japanese Buddhism, they take this one step further and they talk about the moon in the dewdrop. The moon in the dewdrop. So the idea is to find this luminous mind, to find this luminous awakening. And you know, you can go out on a full moon night and look up and see it, which is, you know, not, you know, some full moon days it's cloudy, you don't always see it. But you know, the idea of this, you know, this is a great big thing. But here the Japanese say you see it in something as ephemeral as dewdrop. You come up in the morning and dewdrops tend to disappear very quickly as soon as the sun comes up, they evaporate. Something very ephemeral, very temporary. And so the Japanese are pointing to the temporary and permanent nature, the constantly changing nature of human life and existence. And they're kind of speaking to that. And they say, even in there, or maybe in that, because of that, or in that, you find the moon, the full moon. The moon and the dewdrop. So the moon is not something necessarily something so far away up in the sky, but it's found in even as something as, I don't know if it's the right word, but something as insignificant as a dewdrop. In the small little things of life. So the attempt here is not to make the moon something distant and far from us, but something that's actually integrated and found in this world of ours, in the small little parts of nature. So something as small as a dewdrop. So the dewdrop, moon and the dewdrop, I think is a, you know, beautiful image. Then we come to the 20th century, and one of the great images of the 20th century is that of the earth. Photographed of the Earth from space, photographed the Earth from the Moon, and it's a, you know, it's a powerful image, and it's been used a lot. And some people have them as their flags. Some people I've known who've preferred to put that out in their driveway instead of their American flag. this image is I think again also represents or speaks to people in many different ways. But for some people, it speaks about the earth being our home, a home that's very easy to kind of notice how precious it is or how unique it is, and how it is a home. It's possible to think, you know, my neighborhood, my home is my home, my neighborhood is my home, my city, my state, my country. But to actually get a step back and get a sense of the earth, and maybe how small it is, or how integrated it is, how whole it is, and how we all share it, that's our home. You look further out into space, and it's going to be a while before you find anything comparable. And no one's found one yet. But, not in our galaxy, where is it? You know, so it's quite a phenomenal planet that we live on. And but all the different perfect things coming into just the right balance so that there can be life and us here. And it's quite a phenomenal event that all these different, who knows exactly why life is, but Buddhism basically is content and happy enough with the scientific understandings of it. And and here we sit. You know, some of you are meditating. I don't know what all of you are doing, but some of you are meditating here a little while ago. And some of you maybe weren't always, and maybe you were thinking about what you were going to have for dinner tonight instead of meditating. And it's an awesome thing that you were thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. Because, you know, it's kind of like 5 billion years of evolution has come to that. I mean, it's not an easy thing to think about dinner. You know, for all the different factors in the universe come together like that, it's pretty awesome. It's amazing, amazingly sophisticated and complex event that took many, many, billions of years to be able to come to that pinnacle of existence, you know, at this moment, thinking about dinner. So the earth is our home. Some people love the image of the earth from space because it seems that the kind of the ways in which we divide up our life, the boundaries, us versus them, doesn't seem to exist there on that map, or that picture. The boundaries between countries, you know, kind of like, what does it mean? It kind of like the home for all of us. There's kind of a wholeness, a unity. We're all in it together, as opposed to us versus them. We all share this place, and we're all the same. We're all kind of products or results, children of the same earth, same universe. And some people love the image of the earth in space because it seems somewhat small, or in the big vastness of space, there can be a greater sense of its fragility. And so seeing how fragile it is, how unique it is and special it is, it arouses for some people the desire of certainly reverence, of respect, and perhaps a sense of wanting to care for that and love it in many ways. It's a powerful image, I think, the earth from space. We should have it, you know, flying all the time, that flag. Many years ago, I found this on the wall of a convent. I was teaching a retreat at a Catholic convent, and on the wall they had this: if the earth were only a few feet in diameter, floating a few feet above a field somewhere, people would come from everywhere to marvel at it. People would walk around it, marveling at its big pools of water, its little pools, and the water flowing between the pools. People would marvel at the bumps on it and the holes in it, and they would marvel at the very thin layer of gas surrounding it and the water suspended in the gas. The people would marvel at all the creatures walking around the surface of the ball and at the creatures in the water. The people would declare it as sacred because it was the only one, and they would protect it so that it would not be hurt. The ball would be the greatest wonder known, and people would come to pray to it, to be healed, to gain knowledge, to know beauty, and to wonder how it could be. People would love it and defend it with their lives because they would somehow know that their lives, their roundness, could be nothing without it. if the earth were only a few feet in diameter. When I reflect on this image of the earth from space, you know, to me it's a very moving image. But also, not far from that is a reflection of what it took to get that image. You know, it took a lot of, certainly a lot of scientific knowledge, but it also took a lot of technology. And it took a lot of fuel. And, it took many of the things which are now causing tremendous damage on this planet are kind of in the background of the kind of technological development that goes into having that ability to see the planet from space. So there's kind of a mixed thing here, where the very ability to see the preciousness and the sacredness almost of this planet from space was in some degree dependent on the very forces that have been causing some of the damage to this very sacred place of ours. Now the image of also the image of the earth, you know, the image of the moon in the sky, full moon in the sky, can be seen as quite distant. And the Japanese Buddhists then called it the dew and the dewdrop to bring it back home to this planet. And the idea of the earth also as a ball 2 feet in diameter above a field makes it something other. To have the image of the earth from space, you know, it's also kind of, you know, it's far away from that picture at least. Standing on the moon, you see it far away. Standing on the moon, you know, finally we got to the moon. And turns out enlightenment's not there. You know, once you get close, that's not what it's set up to be. So as long as we hold the earth at a distance, just like we hold the moon at a distance, it's possible to over-idealize the world. And I think that a lot of people over-idealize the world. And one of the ways to over-idealize it is to say it's all good. You know, the Gaia theory, which is a beautiful theory, also posits kind of some people interpret it as being it's this benign, wonderful, perfect kind of system of harmony and balance that we have to be careful not to destroy or disrupt, because otherwise, it'll be destroyed. But it, you know, nature by itself, you know, knows what to do if you just leave it in harmony until the next meteor strikes. Right, and then the whole thing has to fight its own, you know, meteor strikes, and then the balance is destroyed, and it takes a few billion years to discover a new balance. I don't know if we need to kind of over-idealize or idolize at all the nature of the world. Certainly, we need to appreciate the homeostasis, appreciate, I think the Gaia principle is a beautiful principle, but it lends itself kind of to over-idealization. Now, if we go back to the mythologies that different religions have about this human life on Earth, I think there's some interesting contrasts that can be made. Hopefully it's okay to make these contrasts between Christianity and Buddhism. Scholars who've studied religions, there were some scholars in the 60s, 70s, maybe early 80s, who were quite critical of Christianity as having a teaching that talks about being the earth is subservient to human life, and human beings are kind of can do whatever they want. And then with time, other scholars pointed out, well, that's not the full picture, that Christianity wasn't just an environmental hazard. But actually, there's also Christian teachers and Christian teachings that actually emphasize also the sacredness of the earth and being stewards and caretakers of this earth as well. Both are found there. And then people have pointed out that actually to try to go back to the ancient times, whether it's ancient Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism, and try to pull out an environmental ethic from those ancient religions, maybe it's not quite possible or so interesting. I mean, you can squeeze anything out of anything. You know, so it's possible to take Buddhism and kind of squeeze environmental ethic out of its early teachings and teachings of the Buddha, and it's worth doing that. But I think it's a really hard to really kind of get a really well developed environmental ethic from Buddhism, and it isn't that because the Buddha wasn't was you know was a callous environmentalist, you know. But rather, in the ancient world, it wasn't the same issue. The issues weren't the same. They didn't have the picture of the earth from space. We didn't have a sense of the whole interconnectedness that we have nowadays. And so there's a whole different way in which we have to understand what it means to be human, what it means to be alive, and the impact we have on the world. That was not the case over 2,000 years ago. But if you go back to these myths, you know the myths of Eden. Adam and Eve ate the apple of knowledge, and then were banished by God out of the Garden of Eden, out of paradise. And the banishing is God's doing. And then, you know, later on he had this flood. Talking about environmental problems. You know, so God does all these things. And we have to behave a certain way. And if we don't behave a certain way, then God it responds. There's different ways of understanding God. And maybe there's something very profound that both Buddhism and religion and Christianity are saying the same thing. Or the Old Testament says the same thing here. But if you look at the myth, the same kind of myth of creation that exists in Buddhism, which Buddhists almost never refer to. There's a Buddhist myth of creation, and I can give you the reference, but it's it doesn't have such important role in Buddhism. But the myth is one also of beings eating something, not the apple, but they eat, and it's the eating which becomes the problem. And it isn't the apple of knowledge. Knowledge is really important in Buddhism. And part of the function of practice is to get knowledge. But the eating is this way, is that there was a time before there was this earth, before there was matter in the really matter in the universe, kind of. All the living beings of the universe existed as kind of self-luminous kind of spirits or presence or something. Formless, self-luminous beings. And one day, one of them kind of looked down and saw that there was a kind of a sea of some kind of liquid down there. And got curious. And put the finger in there and licked it. And it tasted good. It was delicious. And with that sense of deliciousness came greed. And they wanted more. And as greed developed, these luminous, formless beings started to get more solid. And this kind of liquid started to get more solid as well. And so it got to be chunky, and they started eating it. And then they started getting coarser and coarser, these bodies. And then as these luminous, kind of formless bodies took form, they started taking different kinds of form, different shapes and stuff. And that gave birth to them despising each other because they're different. Aversion arose. And as aversion arose in human beings, they got even coarser. They took more form, more shape. And this kind of stuff, you know, that was first this light liquid became thicker and thicker and became hard ground. And then you couldn't even eat it anymore. But then there sprung up these funguses that were delicious. And so they started eating this. And they got to go around and pick them and ate these mushrooms. But then that only gave birth to more greed. And so then the beings took more form. And then they took the form of male and female, which ended up to other kinds of issues. And then as these other kind of problems of greed and aversion and lust and all kinds of things started happening, those wonderful mushrooms disappeared. And then by that time you had people, and the people had to go out and start farming and collecting seeds and working. And then after a while someone got tired of going out and collecting seeds all the time. So they thought, well, I don't want to go off and collect all the time. I'm just going to make a fence around my place. Or I'm going to collect and just keep a whole bunch of hoard. I'm going to just go out and do it all at once and hoard a lot of this stuff. And then hoarding arose, and then things got got worse. And so what it is, what this mythology is, this myth is trying to point to, is that there's an intimate relationship in this myth between the nature of our universe, our world, and human ethics, the quality of our mind and our activities. And that as we, as beings, as human beings, act with greed, act with aversion and hate, that has an effect on the environment. The environment responds. And in mythology, it's kind of like some kind of mystical or magical kind of connection between the two. But there's an intimate connection between the two. And what I like about this myth is that the relationship between humans and the world is not so separate. It isn't that the world is out there. The world's a 2 feet ball up in the up in the sky that we can relate to out there, and we're here. But rather, there's this kind of inseparable, interdependent, influential relationship between the world and the quality of the human mind. And now that we have some, 6 billion people in the world, when there was just Adam and Eve, just a couple of people in the world, a couple of minds, the quality of the minds is not going to have such a big effect, perhaps. But now with 6 billion people in the world, it's huge, the impact that human behavior has on this world that we have. And so this myth, kind of resonates, I think, pretty well with what we see human life and the earth these days, that the quality of our minds has a big impact on on the quality of the earth that we live in. And a lot of the ways that the earth is being destroyed, a lot of the environmental problems, has its genesis in the human mind, that wants human aversion. You look out across the Bay Area on a smoggy day, and where does that smog come from? And you could say, well, there's no greed there. I just need to get my kids to school. It's reasonable. But is it? And then you get into a car that gets 9 miles per gallon. I'm not responsible. But I need to have my big car because. So this very close connection. So I think that's one of the contributions Buddhism has to make in the discussion of Earth and Earth Day, being caretakers of this wonderful planet of ours. And that is that there is a relationship between caring for the planet and caring for our minds. And that perhaps if we really want to be able to take care of the planet, we have to also be able to take care of our mind. If we don't take care of our mind, our hearts, our ethics, how we behave, then maybe it's kind of a lost cause. If it's only out there, we have to fix something out there. If it's only about fixing what's in here, that's also maybe, maybe that is not going to help so much. But this wonderful mutuality between nature and the world and our own hearts and our own minds, I think is what kind of Buddhism is pointing to. And so we take care of both in that mutual relationship. We take care of the world by taking care of our mind, and we take care of our minds by taking care of the world. Again, if you go to the examples, environmental kind of examples, nature examples in Buddhism, you find a tremendous emphasis in certain strands of Buddhism on the benefits that nature, being in nature, in the forest and places like that, has on the ability to meditate and practice. That the natural environment is a wonderful teacher for anybody interested in this inner transformation that Buddhism is pointing towards. And to go spend time in nature changes your perspective on your sense of self, changes your perspective on some of your things you think that you need, changes your perspective on some of your certainly your relationship to the world and to yourself, sometimes in a very transformative way. When the Buddha was ready to teach his son, the Buddha had a son, one son, one child. And when his son became about 20, he was a monk by then, and been training with his father, under his father for many years, number of years. And at some point his father, the Buddha, felt that he was ready to become awakened, to become liberated. He just needed one more little teaching or something. And he was going to teach him about the nature of not-self. A very profound teaching of Buddhism, that teaching of not-self. Some of you have some sense of it. And if you hear the teaching of not-self, it can seem, you know, kind of, it's easy to do it in kind of a dry way, seems kind of intellectual and certainly disconnected to the world and kind of like, it can even sometimes seem kind of nihilistic. There is no self, people will say. Well, then what? So what the Buddha was going to teach him is very profound and liberating teaching on not-self. But in order to do that, the Buddha took his son deep into the woods, into a grove, and a grove of trees, a tree called the sal trees. And the sal tree is a magnificent tree that grows in India. It's kind of like the redwoods of India. And the Buddha once said, if the sal trees were people, they'd be non-returners. They'd actually be enlightened. So magnificent trees, and they had these big balustrades. What are they called? These roots that are above ground. They kind of like a banyan tree has all. Well, is also, you know, what are they called? These kind of, they make these walls kind of that come out to the side. What are they called? Buttresses. Anyway, so you can kind of sit there, kind of on those buttresses, on those kind of above ground roots, and these big massive trees in the grove. So imagine, you know, sitting there in a, for us here, maybe imagine sitting us in a huge redwood grove of, a virgin redwood trees, you know, sitting there. It's quite an impressive thing to be sitting in a beautiful redwood grove. And in that context, the Buddha taught his son not self. In that context of nature, this magnificent nature, he taught us the most profound teaching he had to teach. Why is that? I don't think it's an accident. Something about nature teaches us about who we are. And I think I believe that it's a lot harder to discover who we are when we lose our connection to nature. And as we discover who we are in some profound way and free ourselves of greed, free ourselves of lust, free ourselves of hate, of aversion, of despair, of fear, of confusion, then I think we start being able to make choices in our life which would much more naturally and easily be responsive to the needs the planet has. I think it's a lot easier to downsize, for example. Some people don't need to have such big cars. Some people don't need to have such big homes. Some people don't need to use so much of the resources in this world. And I think that how that not using so much and how using less and trying to improve this planet of ours becomes a natural thing for us to do comes easily out of spiritual maturity. The suggestion here is that this wonderful interplay between the earth and us, that we're not so separate, we're so the interconnectedness is so strong, that it isn't an obligation to take care of the earth. It isn't that that it's a burden to do it, but really it feels very natural, easy, when there is some degree of freedom from self obsession. So that when we touch the earth, that in some ways we're also touching ourselves. The earth and we are not so separate. So on this Earth Day, 2007, I hope all of you will get off the asphalt. And maybe find a tree, like a redwood tree, and do something that qualifies as touching the earth. Call upon the earth, the goddess of the earth, if you will. And as you do that, kind of remember that it's a really tiny planet. Boy, is it tiny. There are much bigger planets out there. We have a teeny, teeny one in the vastness of space. Let's all share it together with each other in a compassionate, caring way for each other. So that's all I have to say. So thank you very much. Enjoy your Earth Day. Every day.